yes, but his gut told him no. She'd seemed genuinely surprised and embarrassed that someone had entered his room, and he thought her reaction was genuine. She likely knew the secrets and agendas of her customers, including him, and no doubt she'd put two and two together when she saw him huddling in the back room with Sophie and Bloodworth. But she'd been behind the bar the entire time and within Joe's sight. Someone, probably not Miller, had been worried about what Joe was working on and curious how much he knew. Either that, he thought, or something else was going on in the valley that he didn't yet grasp. Maybe the person who'd broken in wasn't involved in Kate's disappearance at all, but was involved in something else. Maybe the presence of a new game warden, for whatever reason, was a threat to them. Whoever it had been was now in possession of everything Joe knew about the case, including his notes. If Billy Bloodworth had excused himself to use the restroom earlier, Joe would know where to look for his file. But Bloodworth was so worried that Sophie would divulge his scoop that he hadn't dared move an inch from the table during their introduction to each other. Was the blurry photo he'd seen on Sophie's phone legitimate? Could that blonde head actually belong to a still alive Kate? He wished he could have studied it. No doubt Bloodworth had more shots in his camera that might be more clear. Then there were the missing keys to Pollock's game warden house, keys that were requested by someone in the governor's office, according to Casey Scales. And the question Bloodworth had asked that Joe couldn't answer with confidence, if these important officials are really trying to get to the bottom of this, why did they send a gamekeeper? Joe dreaded the conversation he'd have to have at some point updating Connor Hanlon or Governor Allen on the progress of his investigation thus far, explaining that the case file had been pilfered before his investigation really began would be painful. That's when he heard footfalls outside in the hall. He turned his head when the footfalls stopped outside his door. There were four shadows of boots, meaning two people. Then a sharp knock. His first thought was that two men had trashed his room and stolen the file, and they'd come back. The security lock prevented them from entering this time. He reached across his body and grasped the hand grip of his weapon and pulled it free from the holster. There was no need to rack the receiver because there was a round in the chamber of his 40 Glock, and of course, no safety, the thumb off. Joe rose and padded to the door and squinted into the peephole. He held his weapon muzzle down alongside his thigh. When he saw who it was, he grunted, unlocked the door, opened it, and stepped aside. Nate Romanowski chuckled as he came inside, followed by a thin man with gaunt eyes whom Joe thought looked familiar from somewhere. They both carried day packs. Nate was tall and broad-shouldered with a blonde ponytail and blue eyes the color of lake ice. There was a sense of calmness about him that was disarming. He flicked his eyes around the room like a raptor.
"What were you going to do with that gun of yours?"
Nate said.
"I know you can't hit the broad side of a warehouse with it."
Before Joe could respond, Nate said,
"The hotels in this town are already closed for the night, so we figured we'd bunk with you."
"Nate?" Nate gently pried the weapon out of Joe's hand and tossed it on the bed. Then he grasped Joe's hand inside both of his. As he did, Nate's heavy canvas Yerrick ink coat gaped open, and Joe noted the grip of his friend's heavy 454 Casull in a shoulder holster inside.
"It's been a while, my friend,"
Nate said.
"It's good to see you even in your underwear."
"Nate?"
"This is Jeff Wasson,"
Nate said, gesturing toward the gaunt man.
"He's a master falconer from Riverton, and I've known him for years, so you can trust him. He's the guy I told you about."
"Nate, why are you here?" Joe asked. The room seemed suddenly very crowded. Wasson didn't make eye contact with Joe, and he seemed to find the walls and fan very interesting.
"We've got a problem, and I told Jeff you were the man who could fix it," Nate said. "I don't need to remind you that you owe me a couple of favors."
"I do, but I've got problems of my own," Nate snorted.
"You always do,"
Joe said.
"Maybe we can help each other."
Chapter 11. As Joe and Nate caught up, Carol Schmidt was wringing out her mop in aisle 7 of Valley Foods, and she thought she heard someone else inside the grocery store. That was odd, because the store closed at 10, and it was nearly 11:30. Schmidt often traded with other employees for the last shift of the night when they'd been assigned to it. She didn't like the last shift any more than they did, of course, but she figured most of the others were young with families at home, and all she had to worry about these days was Bridger, her dog. She'd fed him and let him out before she left encampment to drive the 18 miles north to Saratoga to start her shift. He'd be fine. All he did was sleep anyway. After the store closed and the lights above the doors were turned off, she dimmed the lights inside and locked up. It was the responsibility of the last employee to clean the place up before they left. In the winter, it was an especially onerous responsibility, because every customer who came in tracked snow and mud on the floors. It was an easier job in the summer, when all she had to do was sweep. Because it took so long to mop the aisles, she tried to get a jump on it by starting early, like she had tonight. The only customers in the last hour the store was open on Friday night were single men buying frozen pizzas to take home, or teenagers reeking of weed loading up on pastries and candy. She'd pause her cleaning, check them out, and go back to it when they left. The good things about the teenagers was there was no need to bag up multiple sacks of groceries and take them out to waiting cars in the freezing night. The bad thing about them was they were obviously high on drugs. It bothered her that she recognized a couple of basketball and football players from her attendance at high school games. She'd considered dialing 911 and reporting them, but she knew from recent experience that the dispatcher refused to take her complaints seriously. Carol Schmidt was getting sick and tired of not being taken seriously. 7 aisles were clean, only one more to go in the meat department. Then she heard the scuffle of feet in heavy boots 2 or 3 aisles away. Valley Liquor stayed open until midnight, and it was directly adjacent to the grocery store. It was possible, she thought, that the liquor store manager had simply neglected to close and lock the steel accordion door between the two at 10 o'clock when he was supposed to do it. He might have forgotten, and perhaps a liquor customer had wandered down the steps into the grocery. If so, she'd need to find whoever it was inside and shoo him out, and in all likelihood mop up wet boot prints after he left. "Hello," she called. "Whoever is in here, the store closed at 10. Probably more teenagers, she thought. She shoved her mop into the bucket and walked to the front of the store near the registers. There was a lone pickup in the lot. It was parked about 20 feet from her ancient Toyota 4Runner. She could tell the pickup had been left running because she could see exhaust rising from the tailpipe. In the ambient light from inside, she could barely make out the front license plate. It ended with 600. Schmidt gasped and raised her tiny closed fist to her mouth. She took a long breath and summoned her courage before calling out, "This is the night manager, and you shouldn't be in the grocery store after hours. You need to come up to the front, and I'll let you out." Technically, Schmidt wasn't the night manager, but she thought using the title might give a more authoritative impression.
"On my way."
The grating male voice came from halfway down aisle two. She recognized it immediately from the night the dog was run over on the road next to her house. It was the same voice that had said, "Forget it, leave the goddamn dog. It shouldn't be out running around anyway." She quickly took her place behind the counter at the middle checkout stand where she'd worked earlier in the evening. She felt safer there than if she sought out the man in the aisle. He came from aisle two, around the end cap, with an armful of items. He was big, with white hair, a square jaw, thick lips, and pale blue eyes. She was surprised that his face was familiar to her, but it wasn't from that night she'd encountered him. She recognized his face from a photo in the Saratoga Sun newspaper. He walked up to her register and opened his arms, and the items he'd gathered up spilled onto the counter. Bags of pork rinds, individual energy drinks, jerky, a package of extra-large rubber gloves. "We're closed," she said, thinking about the .38 in her purse that was tucked away in a cubby near her feet. There was also an alarm button under the counter near the cash register, but she'd heard from another checker that the day manager had turned it off because it was too easy to accidentally lean into.
"Yeah," the man said. "I didn't know you were closed. I'll just pay for these few little things and be on my way."
His eyes stayed on her face while he spoke in a way that made the hairs on the back of her neck prick up.
"Do you know who I am?"
he asked. She squared her shoulders and said,
"Everybody does."
She said it even though she couldn't think of his name or who he was with, just that he'd been in the sun. God, she resented not being able to instantly recall things anymore. He chuckled. She said,
"I also know you're the man who ran over that dog in encampment. I saw you do it that night. What kind of person runs over a dog and just leaves it there to suffer?"
He arched his eyebrows and tilted his head a little to the side, as if he was amused by her. Although she was frightened by him, the hot resentment of not being taken seriously took over.
"I told the neighbor who owned the dog," she said. "Then I called the cops on you."
"I'm aware of that, Mrs. Schmidt. I wish you hadn't done that."
"I'll do it again if I have to."
She thought, especially if you have something to do with the smell that's been coming out of the mill burner. And it suddenly all came back to her. The incident she hadn't been able to recall earlier. She looked down so he couldn't read her face.
"Do we have a problem, Mrs. Schmidt?"
His words chilled her to her soul, but she didn't dare look up at him. He was big and he looked fit. There was no way she could run away from him. If she bent down to dig out her purse, he could reach over the counter and pick her up like a twig and snap her in half.
"The groceries, I mean,"
he said.
"We have a problem that I've picked them out, and you haven't rung them up."
Then he grinned. She realized she was trembling. She gestured to the items.
"You can get all those things down at the come and go. You don't need to buy them here, except for the rubber gloves. I don't know if the come and go has them."
"No, I'd rather pay for them now and be on my way."
She shook her head quickly.
"The register's turned off. I don't have a key to open it up after hours."
"So now you want to lie to me?"
he asked, arching his eyebrows again.
"Why would you do that, Mrs. Schmidt?"
"Because I want you to go away. It's after hours and you're not supposed to be here."
"But I am."
"I guess I'm scared of you," she said.
He reached out and grasped her hand with both of hers. When she tried to pull back, he tightened his grip. His hands were rough and enormous.
"You don't need to be scared of me, Mrs. Schmidt,"
he said in a near whisper.
"You just need to learn to mind your own business. You need to just enjoy your little home there across from the mill and you need to not be so quick to grab the phone and call 911 anytime you feel like it. You need to be a little more trusting, and not always assume the worst about people, even if they're newcomers to the valley. Do you understand what I'm telling you, Mrs. Schmidt?
She nodded, barely. She could no longer meet his eyes.
Was that a yes?
He asked. His voice was gentle. Yes.
Then I guess we're done here,
he said.
So, can you ring me up, or do you want me to put these things back on the shelves?
Just take them, she said.
That wouldn't be right, would it?
Just take them and get out. He stood there, hulking above her. He still had her hand.
I'm not going to let you talk me into stealing, Mrs. Schmidt. Then you really would have something to tell the police, wouldn't you? Tell you what,
he said, finally letting go. He reached behind him for his wallet and withdrew a $50 bill from it and placed it on the counter.
You take the cost of the groceries out of that and keep the rest. That way we're square.
I can't do that, she said.
Sure you can, he said, gathering up the items. Now I'd appreciate if you'd please unlock the door so I can get out of your store. I can tell you're quite rattled, and I'm sorry I'm responsible for that.
She could barely feel her legs as she walked from behind the counter to the double doors. He was right behind her. She expected a blow to the head any second. The key rattled around outside the lock until she finally got it in and turned the bolt. A gust of freezing air washed over her as the door opened.
You have a pleasant night, Mrs. Schmidt,
the man said as he passed by her.
Remember, mind your own business, and everything will be fine.
She watched his wide back as he walked toward the pickup. There was no one else in the cab. Before he opened the door and the dome light came on, he turned and looked at her and gestured for her to turn around. She did. As she locked the door from the inside, she glanced up to see the truck back up and turn for the highway. Schmidt didn't have a cell phone. She had to go all the way to the rear of the store to the manager's office to call 911 and report what had just happened. She was still shaking, and she was angry with herself as she drove toward Encampment on the dark highway. She was extra cautious, as always, because there was ice on the road, and the 18-mile distance was famous for deer, antelope, and elk at night. The dispatcher had been alarmed at first when Schmidt told her someone had been in the store after hours and refused to leave. But with every question the dispatcher asked, Schmidt's confused answers made the situation seem more and more benign. Did he actually threaten you? The dispatcher asked. Or did he say the two of you had a problem because he wanted to buy some items and you didn't want to turn the register on?
Both, she explained. But it sounded like a threat. It felt like a threat.
Did he grab you physically or just reach out and hold your hand? The dispatcher had asked.
When he was standing there in front of me, I remember that smell, all right. The same smell as my daddy's field that time.
The dispatcher said,
What smell? From the mill burner.
Now, I'm really confused, the dispatcher said. I thought this was about someone in the grocery store after hours. Her words came rushing out.
My daddy was a cattle rancher over by Yoder, and I grew up on the ranch. When I was little, maybe 10 or 11, he discovered a dead body out in the irrigation ditch. You see, there used to be a lot of hobos around in those days. We didn't call them homeless like we do today. They were just hobos who would show up at the front door and work a day or two on a ranch and then go on their way. My daddy recognized that dead hobo as one who had worked on our place the week before. Daddy figured that hobo had taken the money we paid him and bought cheap alcohol and stumbled into the irrigation ditch. Daddy didn't trust the local sheriff, and he didn't want any of us involved in finding a dead body on our place, especially because it would raise suspicion and questions, I guess. So Daddy pulled the body out of the ditch and built a big pile of branches and boards. Then he put that hobo on top and lit it up. I'll never forget the smell of that burning hobo. But it didn't come back to me until he was standing there in front of me. It was the same smell that came from the mill burner that night.
"That's quite a story, Mrs. Schmidt," the dispatcher said. By then, Schmidt knew she'd lost the conversation, that everything she said made her sound more batty and disoriented. "Come in tomorrow and talk to one of the officers," the dispatcher counseled. "Maybe after some rest, you'll be able to make a little more sense."
When her rear window suddenly filled with headlights, Schmidt naturally eased over to the side of the highway so the speeding vehicle could pass her. She clicked her tongue at whomever would drive so fast and so recklessly on a snow-packed roadway with deer and antelope lurking just off the shoulder in the dark brush. When she glanced up, there was a pair of headlights so close to her Toyota, she could actually see the bulbs and the license plate. 600. The impact was bone-jarring. Chapter 12.
So, you came all the way down here to ask about falconry permits? Joe asked Nate and Jeff Wasson with suspicion at breakfast at the Saratoga Hot Springs Resort. He looked at Nate. Why didn't you just call me?
There's not a lot going on in the nuisance bird abatement business in January, Nate said. Besides, I have other business here.
Joe waited for more that didn't come. Nate was like that. Joe had long given up trying to penetrate his cryptic pronouncements. Wasson said, Nate told me you'd want to hear my story. When he said he was driving down here, I figured I'd come along for the ride and meet you in person. Joe shot Nate a disapproving glance, and Nate smiled back with mischief. Serious master falconers were a different breed, Joe knew. They ate, drank, and slept falconry. Their lives were shaped around it, and their outlook on life came from a severe perspective, in which the practice of falconry was tantamount to everything else. When they had problems or disagreements, falconers often had a tough time believing that their concerns wouldn't be shared by those outside their world if just given enough explanation. Falconers were passionate, willful, and obstinate.
I've got a lot on my plate right now, Joe said to Wasson.
Nate said you always do, but I was hoping you'd give me a few minutes. This is important.
They were in a high-backed booth in a space just off the darkened bar and lounge area, where the bar stools were metal saddles with pointing six guns for armrests. The sprawling complex on the bank of the North Platte River featured private hot springs and had been known as the Saratoga Inn for so many years that locals still referred to it as the Inn. They were the only guests in the restaurant, and even a crackling fire in the fireplace couldn't warm it up yet. Joe had slept in his bed, and Nate and Wasson had unrolled sleeping bags on the floor of his room. Joe recalled that he hadn't been in a similar situation since college when friends and acquaintances had crashed in his dorm room for the night. This was nothing unusual for Nate, who sometimes slept in the crook of a tree or in a cliffside cave while waiting for raptors to return to their nests. But Joe thought, I'm getting too old for this. Wasson snored, and Joe didn't get much sleep because of his guests as well as the incidents the night before. While he hoped that he could make more sense of the situation in the morning, he found that his head was fogged up. A waitress wearing a down vest and fleece-lined boots approached the table and asked for their order. As they studied the menu, she said, "Did you hear about that accident on the highway last night?"
"What accident?"
Joe asked.
A dear old lady who works at the grocery store slid off the road into a deep ditch. They found her this morning, and from what I hear, she's probably not going to make it. Can you imagine being trapped in a wrecked car all night with it this cold outside? It's really awful.
I'm sorry to hear that, Joe said.
Mrs. Schmidt, the waitress said, shaking her head. I'm in the garden club with her. She was, I mean, is, such a sweetheart.
Let's hope she makes it, the waitress said. Wasson waited impatiently for the waitress to take their order to the kitchen, and then he leaned across the table toward Joe, his eyes lit up from the inside. After explaining that both he and his wife were former schoolteachers who'd recently been laid off due to budget cuts in Riverton, he began,
I'm one of a handful of falconers in the country who is licensed to possess and hunt with a golden eagle. My wife and I both have federal permits we obtained years ago through the Wyoming Game and Fish Department. We used our eagles to hunt jackrabbits, snowshoe hare, and pheasants, but we knew our birds were capable of much, much more. It was like taking an F-16 fighter jet out to hunt deer, you know?
Joe knew. Male golden eagles weighed up to 10 pounds and had wingspans exceeding 8 feet. The gripping strength in their talons could bring a strong man to his knees. Wasson said,
Do you know that falconers in Mongolia use eagles to hunt fox, wolves, and deer? It's amazing. It's like the kind of falconry you're used to, but blown up to a whole different level. You can find clips of it on YouTube.
Joe nodded. His longtime friendship with Nate had taught him plenty about the lethal capabilities of falcons and hawks. He was aware that falconry was the sport of kings in the Middle East, and that American and British falconers had adapted the practice to better suit the more egalitarian cultures of the Western world.
Mongolian falconers sometimes use two birds in tandem to take down large prey, Wasson said.
So we know it's possible. But as far as I can tell, and believe me, I've talked to every falconer in the country with an eagle permit, it's never been done over here. But even though I have the license and I've studied falconry with eagles for 30 years, I can't get permission to try it here.
You're getting ahead of yourself,
Nate said to Wasson.
He won't understand what you're asking unless you go back to the beginning.
The beginning? Joe said with caution. He figured he only had enough time for them to have breakfast together before he resumed his investigation into Kate's disappearance. Wasson said,
You probably know about the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act that was passed in the 1940s to save both birds. It was a, quote,
Wasson made quote marks with his fingers in the air,
good thing, but, like all good things, there were unintended consequences when politicians and bureaucrats with no wildlife experience decide to play God. Think about when the feds introduced Canadian gray wolves into Yellowstone, where Canadians had never been before, or...
Stay on topic,
Nate commanded. Wasson blinked from the rebuke, but didn't take offense. Joe assumed Nate often had to ask Wasson to get to the point. Falconers did tend to go on.
Anyway, Wasson said, the eagle population increased at the same time herds of sheep were growing across the state. That's when the prices of wool and meat were high before the Australians entered the picture. Eagles figured out that lambs were really good to eat. Lambs are easy prey. They have lots of meat. And ewes don't try very hard to defend them. Sheep ranchers all over the West were getting hammered by eagles, and a few bad ranchers tried to fight back by poisoning eagles or hunting them from the air.
Joe nodded. He'd heard the stories.
In 1972, the act was amended. The fines for unlawfully killing an eagle were increased significantly, and the law specified that ranchers could lose their federal grazing leases if they got caught killing an eagle. At the same time, the act was fixed to allow falconers to obtain eagles associated with depredation of livestock or other wildlife.
Eagles are great creatures, but they're eagles. In addition to killing lambs, they also like to kill bighorn sheep lambs. Oh, and golden eagles are the number one aerial predator of adult sage grouse. The mention of sage grouse made Joe sit up. Sage grouse were radioactive when it came to state politics and policy. The survival of the chicken-sized bird was a massive topic of controversy in Wyoming and other western states, and it affected energy exploration and land use regulations in general. He'd been involved with a case in which someone had slaughtered an entire population called a lek, and the incident's far-reaching consequences had swept in multiple federal agencies and nearly shut down the energy economy in northern Wyoming. "Now I've got your attention," Wasson said with triumph. Nate looked on with an amused expression. Joe ignored his friend. Their breakfasts arrived, three orders of biscuits and gravy with bacon on the side. Joe dug into his while Wasson ignored his plate and continued on. After the Falconry Amendment was added to the Act, it took a typically long time, about 20 years, for the feds to finally write the regulations for it. Finally, falconers like me who'd obtained a license could hunt with an eagle. We're not talking about hundreds of birds, either. We're talking about just a few 1 to 3 year old eagles. It was an absolute win-win-win for all concerned, Wasson said. If wool growers were getting their lambs slaughtered, they could call the U.S. Department of Agriculture Wildlife Services Agency, and the agency would allow falconers like me to go to the ranch and trap the birds for hunting. That saved lambs. It also saved countless sage-grouse and other wildlife, and it allowed me and other master falconers to advance the art of falconry with eagles. That lasted until 2009, Wasson said. That's when the last administration suspended the program without any notice. We could no longer trap and fly eagles, so unless you had a pre-2009 eagle in your mews, you were shit out of luck. Joe was puzzled. Why did they do that? Wasson slammed the table with both open hands and did it hard enough that the silverware danced. Someone needs to find out, he shouted. Someone needs to rattle the cages of those federal bureaucrats to start up the program again. If you've noticed, ranchers are raising sheep again and lambs are getting killed again, and who knows how many of the state's precious sage-grouse are getting slaughtered. Before Joe could respond, Wasson gestured to Nate. We all look up to this guy, as you know. Some of us falconers have been involved with some kind of shady stuff in the past, like growing premium weed or selling trapped peregrines to Arab interests and things like that. Joe narrowed his eyes, and Wasson backed away from the topic so quickly it was as if his hands were singed. Joe figured Wasson must have been warned by Nate that he was a by-the-book law enforcement officer who wouldn't hesitate to arrest Wasson. And it was true. Wasson said, I could have gone back to that after the school district let me go, but I saw how Nate went legit. He left his old life behind, and he's raking in money hand over fist with Yerrick, Inc., helping out farmers and ranchers with problem birds, many of them invasive species. In a lot of cases, all he has to do is deploy his Air Force, and the problem birds see what they're up against and just go away. Nate referred to his growing arsenal of red-tail hawks, prairie falcons, peregrine falcons, and gerfalcons as his Air Force, Joe knew. So I contacted half a dozen sheep ranchers a while back, Wasson said. They told me coyotes had replaced eagles as the number one killer of their lambs. Coyotes are exploding in numbers, as you know. My idea is to hunt two eagles at a time to take out coyotes on the ground, the same way the Mongolians used two eagles to kill wolves. These ranchers will hire me directly to trap eagles that are killing their lambs and use them to kill coyotes that are doing the same thing. Another win-win-win. But it's January and spring is a few months away. I can't get anyone in D.C. on the phone to help me get permission to trap an eagle or two. And I'm not the only one. No licensed falconer has been allowed to trap an eagle to fly since 2009, Wasson said again. It's not against the law. It's not wrong. It helps ranchers and saves sage-grouse. Coyotes are predators, and they breed like rabbits. The eagles aren't harmed, but I can't get permission to hunt with an eagle.
Which is where you come in, Nate said to Joe. You can do the right thing and get involved.
Joe shrugged. I don't have any connection with the feds in D.C. who could issue the permits. That's above my pay grade.
Which is where you come in, Nate said again, this time emphasizing every word.
Then Joe got it.
You want me to talk to Governor Allen? Bingo, Nate said.
Joe sat back. I'm not sure I have any influence with him.
Nate said, You know him. You work for him. He's the reason you're down here.
To be honest, I'm not sure why I'm here, Joe confessed. It doesn't feel right.
But if you manage to do whatever it is he's asked you to do, won't he owe you a favor?
Nate asked.
Nate, he's the governor. He's a politician, Nate said. And I think he's a certain kind of politician, the kind who operates in the world of favors.
Maybe, Joe said, but that's not the kind of thing I want to get involved in. I don't do political.
Nate smirked, and Joe felt his face get hot. He hated the idea of feeling compromised, but he wasn't sure he could make a cogent argument to the contrary.
Nate said,
I took a job this fall around Big Piney, and I learned a few things about our governor. I think that if you pull this assignment off, he'll owe you in spades.
I don't understand.
Look, Nate said, I have nothing to do right now. Liv is back in Louisiana visiting relatives for the month. Yerrick Inc. is dormant until spring. I can help you out with your assignment, and maybe the governor will owe you one.
Wasson kept nodding his head and looking between Nate and Joe. It was obviously going the way he wanted it to go. Joe thought about it. I've got a lot of ground to cover in a short time, not to mention that someone stole the case file from my room last night, and whoever it was knows why I'm here.
Nowhere to go but up, Nate offered. Give me the names of the people you want me to talk to. As you know, I can be persuasive when it comes to getting information.
Joe snorted. None of that, Nate. This needs to be a clean investigation. We can't have broken bones and ears ripped off.
I'll keep my head down and I'll behave, Nate said. I don't want to get crosswise with the new governor or the feds again.
The governor's chief of staff doesn't want you involved in this, Joe said.
He's an ass,
Nate grinned, and Joe realized he'd all but accepted his assistance. He was grateful for the help.
This is your cue to leave,
Nate said to Wasson.
Eat your breakfast and then go back to Riverton. I'll let you know how things work out.
Wasson looked from Nate to Joe and back again. Joe didn't encourage him to stay either.
I guess I gave it my best shot, Wasson said.
To Joe, thanks for listening to me.
I haven't done anything yet, Joe reminded him.
When Wasson was gone, Joe looked long and hard at his friend across the table.
What?
Nate asked.
I know you. There's something going on besides getting Wasson and his friends eagle licenses.
Nate didn't react.
Wasson is a master falconer. There aren't many of us, and we're brothers.
There was no tell on his face, but Joe still suspected there was more than eagles on Nate's mind. His mentions of other business, as well as information he was holding close about the governor, seemed to indicate he had a private agenda, Joe thought.
"Look, I know how much you enjoy conspiracy theories," Nate said.
"I don't.
So I'm not going to burden you with another one right now. Not until I know more."
"I appreciate that.
But you have to admit, I've been more right than wrong over the years."
Joe started to object, but caught himself. Nate took to conspiracy theories in a natural way, like he'd taken to falconry. Nate had a unique, unvarnished way of looking at the world without preconceptions or faith in institutions, especially government institutions. Most times, Joe didn't automatically ascribe evil intentions to men and women with power and authority. Nate was just the opposite. He'd told Joe more than once that Joe was the only person in law enforcement that he trusted.
"But you'll let me know if you come up with something legitimate," Joe asked.
"I will."
Joe briefed Nate on the Kate Shelford Longdon disappearance and tried to recall as many of the names and detail as he could without the case file. As he talked, Joe scribbled down bullet points and specific suspect names on the back of a Saratoga Hot Springs Resort napkin. Next to each name, he assigned which of them would be responsible for making contact. "I'll take Steve Pollock," Joe said. "There's something really hinky about him leaving the agency with no notice. I'm just waiting for a set of keys right now so I can get into his house."
"Who needs keys?"
Nate asked. "I do," Joe said with a sigh. "I'll also take Mark Gordon. He's the GM of the Silver Creek Ranch. I don't consider him a suspect, and neither did the DCI agent, but he's a good place to start. I'll quiz Sheridan and head wrangler Lance Ramsey about what they recall about Kate and who she hung out with during her stay." Nate raised his eyebrows.
"Sheridan's here?"
Joe explained the situation. Sheridan had once been Nate's apprentice in falconry, and the two of them had a special relationship. The apprenticeship had been postponed for years while Sheridan attended college, and Nate was on the payroll of Wolfgang Templeton, as well as in and out of federal custody.
"I want to catch up with her,"
Nate said.
"I'm sure you'll have that opportunity."
"And she's got a thing going with this Lance guy?"
"How did you know?" Joe asked suspiciously.
"By the way you said his name, head wrangler Lance Ramsey, like he's in your head a little."
"Maybe he is,"
Nate smirked.
"Is he a suspect?"
"I've got no reason to put him on that list."
"Maybe to get him to stop seeing Sheridan?"
Nate suggested. He shook his head. "He seems like a good guy." Joe said he'd follow up with farriers Ben and Brady Youngberg since they'd tangled the night before, and he gave the names of the fish hatchery owners, Jack and Joshua Tubner, to Nate to check out. He explained DCI agent Michael Williams' theory that it was more likely a ranch contractor who took Kate than an employee. He wrote down the name Richard on the napkin and next to it the initials MBP. "Richard Cheatham is Kate's ex-husband," Joe said. "She kept her maiden name. We always have to look at the X. And because he's in England, I'll ask Mary Beth to get online and check him out."
"Smart,"
Nate said. "I'll take Jeb Pryor, the encampment lumber mill owner," Joe said. "I might be wrong, but I got a vibe off him last night that he knows something he wants to tell me." Then Joe described what he knew about Sophie and Billy Bloodworth. "My guess is you'll run into them without even trying," Joe said. "They stand out. Like I said, I've talked with them, and Sophie flashed a blurry photo on her phone that indicated they think they've determined a suspect. No names, though, and Bloodworth is protective of the information. I couldn't get any more out of them, and they wouldn't let me look closely at the photo.
Bloodworth is the fop, right?
Joe grinned. Yep, he's the fop. I was thinking that if you had a chance to have a conversation with them, and they didn't know you were connected to me or the investigation...
They might tell me something,
Nate said, finishing Joe's sentence.
Maybe I can get a hold of that photo.
Sophie might find you interesting, Joe said. If you could get her away from Bloodworth, that is. She's single and a little playful. Nate arched his eyebrows again. Joe didn't say more because he didn't need to. Nate's effect on some women was well known to them both. Mary Beth had said as much, and Joe tried not to think too much about that. I'm serious about not busting any heads, Joe said.
I agree.
So you have to promise me that if the situation gets dangerous, you'll back off and call me. I know how you are. Can you do that? Nate grinned in a way that made Joe uncomfortable.
Nate? Okay, okay. But I might have to use my judgment at some point.
As he said it, Nate opened the left side of his jacket so once again Joe could see the butt of his .454 Casull revolver in a shoulder holster. The five-shot weapon made by Freedom Arms was one of the most powerful handguns in the world, and Nate was deadly with it. Wyoming had few restrictions when it came to the open or concealed carrying of firearms in public, so Nate wasn't breaking any laws.
Keep it in the holster, Joe said. It never comes out, unless I need to use it.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
You've got your phone, right? Joe asked. Nate patted his breast pocket with annoyance. He'd once eschewed the use of cell phones, but with Yerrick Inc. and Liv in Louisiana, he was now married to it.
Does it still read Dudley Do-Right on the screen when I call you? Joe asked.
Not only that, but a cartoon image of the big-chinned Canadian Mountie also appeared.
It does.
You wouldn't want to change that, would you?
No. It fits.
Joe sighed and turned back to his napkin. For the first time since he'd spoken to Governor Allen about Kate's disappearance, he felt that he had a solid plan of action, with or without the case file. Nate had helped give him that confidence.
Thank you, he said.
Nate shrugged.
It's good to be doing something. Maybe we'll even find out what happened.
Joe laughed.
One thing, though,
Nate said as they got up from the booth.
Why you? Why would Allen send you down here when he has hundreds of government lackeys working for him?
Joe shoved his hands in his front pockets as he walked toward the lobby. Trying to figure that out myself, he said.
Ah,
said Nate. He said it in a way that indicated Joe had just confirmed something Nate had been thinking. Chapter 13. Across town and across the river, Ted Panos climbed out of his four-wheel drive in the parking lot of the J.W. Hugus and Company restaurant. He'd parked next to a late-model pickup with a camper shell. Steam rolled from the open ovals on the otherwise frozen river, which made the ducks and geese on the open water look like carnival booth silhouettes. The openings were created by thermal springs within the river, he'd been told. His boot soles squeaked on the icy surface, and he thrust his hands into his coat pockets and cursed. It was so cold it took you by surprise, he thought. The sky was cloudless, and the morning sun lit the buildings and dormant river trees with such vibrant light that it made his brain think it was warm out. But it wasn't. The cold pinched your skin between icy fingers and gave it a sharp twist. He'd never get used to it, and he was starting to wonder if spring would ever come. The thick file was clamped under his right arm, so he pushed through the door with his left hand. The door was made of steel, and it bit his bare hand. Inside, he stood still on the map for a moment because his eyeglasses had fogged up. When they cleared, he saw Galen Kessel sitting by himself in the corner booth he always took. Kessel was looking up at him coolly, a pair of readers pushed halfway down his nose. An empty breakfast plate was pushed to the side with a crumpled napkin on top of it. A waitress came out of the kitchen to greet Panos, but when she recognized him right away, she gestured toward Kessel's booth. She knew the routine.
"Cold one out there, isn't it?"
"No shit."
"My car's got vinyl seats," the waitress said. "When I climbed in this morning to come to work, they cracked. And when I got it started up, two geese flew out from underneath it."
"That's cold," he said.
"It's got to warm up soon, don't you think?"
"I have no idea," he said ruefully. "This is my first winter here. I hope it's my last."
"Oh, I like it," she said. "It keeps the riffraff out."
Panos cursed under his breath. Kessel shifted in the booth with impatience.
"I'll have my usual," Panos said.
He liked the chicken-fried steak and eggs with a side of biscuits and gravy in this place, and ordered it nearly every morning.
"Coming up,"
the waitress said, and retreated into the kitchen to tell the cook. There were no other customers in the restaurant. Panos knew Kessel liked it that way.
"You got it," Kessel said as Panos slid into the booth next to him. He meant the file.
Panos nodded and slid it across the formica top to him.
"Anybody see you?"
Kessel asked.
"No."
"You sure?"
"Yes. The keys were right there where you said they'd be. And I tossed the room to make it look like a robbery, just like you asked. The game warden was in the bar talking to those foreigners the whole time."
Kessel nodded, but offered no praise. He never did. Panos had learned that Kessel simply expected excellence at all times, and as long as he did exactly as he was told and offered no excuses for failing, they got along all right. Panos dreaded the consequences when he screwed up, as he had a few weeks ago when he'd been instructed to keep watch on a subject and had lost him. It hadn't been Panos's fault. Kessel told him to watch the house and see where the guy went in his company truck. The company truck remained parked in the driveway. He hadn't told him about a back door or that the subject had a second car back there. When he explained that to his boss, Kessel had tensed up and balled his fists, and for a moment Panos thought he was going to beat him. Panos knew he wouldn't be able to defend himself. Kessel seemed to be constructed of cinder blocks. His arms were the size of Panos's thighs, and his fists were like two hams. When he'd seen Kessel shed his shirt that afternoon at the Saratoga hot pool, it confirmed that he'd be no match for the man. Plus, the scars from one or more knife fights looked like pale zippers across Kessel's broad chest. His snow-white hair was deceiving, because Kessel was younger and more fit than he looked at first glance. For the rest of that day, Kessel didn't say a word to him. Finally, as they parted in the evening, Kessel said,
"Ted?"
"Yes?"
"Don't ever fuck up again. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"I do."
Kessel had driven away, and Panos hadn't screwed up again. Since that day, Panos had tucked a two-barreled Bond Arms 45 Derringer into his boot top. He'd bought it at Coyote Sports in town. It was a tiny weapon, but it packed a wallop. He never revealed the presence of the weapon to Kessel. If the man did attack him, he hoped he could get to it in time. He'd aim for center mass with the first shot. A point-blank 45 round would stop even a bear like Kessel. Then he'd finish the man off with a shot to the head. He'd have to finish him off. A wounded Galen Kessel was more terrifying than a living Galen Kessel.
Panos kept silent as Kessel read through the file page by page in front of him. The waitress delivered his breakfast, and he ate quietly. Panos knew very little about Kessel except for a few side comments he'd heard him make. He knew he'd been in the army during Desert Storm, and he'd liked it so much he hired on after his deployment with a mercenary outfit. As Kessel put it, he got to see the world and kill men of every hue. He had a low, grating voice that made everything he said seem menacing. Kessel was from Minnesota, which he once referred to as Mini-So-Cold. The cold didn't seem to bother him at all, Panos noted. Kessel often went outside without a coat, and Panos had to beg the man to turn up the heat when they rode together in the pickup with a camper shell. Kessel always drove. Panos was from Las Vegas, New Mexico, originally. It had been cold down there, especially in the mountains, but nothing like this. After a stint in the Air Force, Panos had taken a job as a correctional officer at the New Mexico State Penitentiary in Santa Fe. It was dangerous work, and the general population was filled with gangbangers, both domestic and illegal, Aryan supremacists, and various reprobates of every stripe. The authorities who ran the place were so spooked not to repeat the infamous New Mexico prison riot of 1980, when 33 men had been murdered, some by having lengths of steel rebar shoved through their heads, that they'd urged the COs to ruthlessly clamp down on violators. Panos had been an enthusiastic practitioner of the edict, and he'd never had a problem with cracking heads. There was one inmate in particular, a lifer who'd participated in the riot and considered it a badge of honor, who caused trouble as a matter of course. His attitude was, what more could they do to him? Panos and a few other COs decided to teach the prisoner a lesson. They'd held the miscreant down so they could pry his closed eyes open for a point-blank blast of pepper spray. When the scumbag went blind and later sued the Department of Corrections and won, Panos, as well as four other experienced COs, had lost their jobs. Panos was still bitter about it. He'd bounced around after that, taking any security officer job that paid a few dollars more per hour than the one he currently had. He couldn't even imagine not being in law enforcement of some kind, even if the jobs barely rated over mall cop. It was a miserable existence without the state insurance, perks, and pension he'd had for two decades. His wife, Gabriella, had left him and taken their three kids. So when Galen Kessel interviewed Panos a few months before and said that blinding a perverted loser might be a recommendation instead of a detriment, Panos leapt at the opportunity. He'd encountered men like Kessel in the military and on the inside, and he admired them. Men who lived their own lives, stood up for themselves, and administered justice to those who deserved it. When Panos learned how much he'd be paid, and that the position came with benefits that surpassed even what the state of New Mexico had offered, it was like icing on the cake. Of course, that had occurred in the early fall, when the temperatures during the day were in the 60s and 70s, and trees were just starting to turn color near the river. He'd welcomed the still, cool, and crisp nights, which was when he and Kessel did most of their work, and he'd had no idea what it would be like in January during a historic cold snap. Kessel closed the file and sighed. He said, "Nothing to worry about here." "Really?" Panos asked, as he sopped up the last of the sausage gravy with the last of the biscuit.
"Nah."
"Good.
We have to keep an eye on him, though. We can't let him get too close. But right now, he's on the wrong track."
Kessel, Panos had learned, had a lot of duties in addition to overall security. One of them was combing the upper North Platte River Valley for additional wind tower locations, as well as ranch property for company executives who might want to visit or live there eventually. They'd even found themselves on the back roads of a high-end dude ranch known as the Silver Creek Ranch. Unfortunately, a female employee had made them at the time. Panos didn't ask which particular track the game warden was following because he knew Kessel wouldn't elaborate. Kessel leaned forward to make sure the waitress was back in the kitchen gossiping with a cook and couldn't overhear them.
You know that old lady who called the cops, the busybody?
Panos felt a cold pang of fear shoot through his chest. He nodded.
She's not going to be a problem anymore, Kessel said.
Panos tried not to react. He didn't want Kessel to know how scared he was of being implicated.
An accident, Kessel said. She slid off the highway on her way home last night.
I'm sorry to hear that, Panos said.
Yeah, me too, Kessel said with the slightest grin. Because soon we need to make another run.
Already?
Something about the weather, Kessel said.
I'll dress warm.
You do that, Kessel said with a smirk.
Chapter 14. After breakfast, Joe drove to Steve Pollock's old house at the top of the hill and bucked a deep snowdrift in the back driveway that nearly launched his pickup into the garage door. Luckily, he was able to stop the truck 3 feet away. He got out and looked around. The garage was attached to the back of the house. From where he was parked, he couldn't